Her next case on the docket is case number 21-2320, Salazar v. AT&T Mobility. Mr. Kihani, whenever you're ready, please proceed. Did I say your name correctly?
Yes, Your Honor.
Oh, great.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Darius Kehani. I represent the patent owner and the plaintiff in this case, Joe Andrew Salazar, on this appeal. The issue here on appeal is directed to one basic principle that is precedent in this court. Comes out of the Baldwin case, and where this court has noted that there are very limited, extremely limited exceptions, and unless there is an unmistakable indication in the specification or the prosecution history or the language of the claims, the language A component means one or more components.
Do you think that the district court interpreted a microprocessor to be a single microprocessor? Because I didn't necessarily read the construction that way. And
no, Your Honor. The district court interpreted a microprocessor to mean one or more microprocessors. However, it interpreted the later definite article said microprocessor not to go back and refer to a one or more, but rather to a single microprocessor.
I think it may have said one or more, but that would mean, let me give you an example, a microprocessor, and say that was two microprocessors. Then it says said microprocessor performing function X. It would have to be at least one. It could be the two microprocessors that both perform the later function, but there has to be at least one. You can't mix and match. I think what the district court was saying is you can't, even if there's multiple microprocessors in the first reference to a microprocessor, when you later have the same language, said microprocessor, the microprocessor, performing different functions, it can't be that you can say, well, this is one microprocessor does this and one microprocessor does that, kind of like the dog analogy that was in the district court's opinion. If you have a dog that fetches and sits, you can't satisfy that by having one dog that fetches and one dog that sits.
Well, that it depends on the structure and of the language. In like, for example, in Revarma, where you had a preamble, and in Convolve, where you had a preamble that connected, for example, in Convolve, a user interface directly connected to, linked to the processor, there was a specific recitation of a relationship and a limitation. Whereas in RECO and in, for example, O1 Communique, where you have a group, where the Baldwin rule and progeny say you have a group of items, A equals one or more. If any subsequent reference back to the A equals one or more is only limited to a single item, that subsumes and renders meaningless the principle in Baldwin. So here in Salazar's claims, we have a communication, command, and control and sensing system in the preamble described, comprising, so the dog is a communication, command, control and sensing system in Salazar is what we argue. It's not a microprocessor. The preamble of the claim speaks to a communication, command, control, and sensing system comprising then a microprocessor that is coupled to a microprocessor that has the following functions. So all these functions that come after, if you say that a microprocessor is a single microprocessor that has to do all these things, then you really don't have one or more microprocessors. You just have a single microprocessor. And it renders the rule meaningless. And in the case of, you know, in both in Revarma and in Convolve that was argued, the language was very specific where it was defining the invention that had that, for example, statistical analysis had to be connected to two investments specifically, or that the user interface had to be connected to the processor. That's how the invention was described, and then came comprising, and then had these various limitations. So that's the distinction we draw here, is that if only one microprocessor, as Your Honor described, would have to do, if one microprocessor had to do all these other functions, then a microprocessor, meaning one or more microprocessors, would be meaningless, because simply it would be one microprocessor. Those additional microprocessors would have no additional meaning, because one microprocessor would have to do everything that was recited in the claims.
But isn't that the drafter's responsibility? If the claims, if the word said microprocessor for creating and a memory device coupled to said microprocessor and the user interface coupled to said microprocessor, if it was wanted, if it was desired to be written in a way where it wasn't referring back to at least one of the same microprocessors as referred to above, wasn't there some responsibility on the part of the patent owner to write it that way?
The court's precedent that says in the drafting that A equals one or more means you have a plurality now. And now when you refer back to that group, you don't now relinquish or narrow, you don't go now from a plural to a single. So when you say said microprocessor, we're saying that if a microprocessor equals one or more microprocessors, and you say, you know, said microprocessor has various functions, you mean any one of that group of one or more has those functions. I mean, this claim, if you take this narrow construction, Your Honor, I mean, the drafter, the inventor, which you would have to say every phone, smartphone has dozens of microprocessors possibly in them. You would limit this patent, where it's, in the specification it speaks to so many microprocessors, to one microprocessor would have to do everything. And that would not be a reasonable construction. What we have here, in terms of the scope of the invention, and so we have this precedent, which this court has applied in the way we're describing. Even this district court in the case Freeney applied the same principle, the same way that we're arguing it should be applied. And this court has, in, as I said, O1 Communique, it has in RECO, it says that you don't have to have the same one of the A to do all the functions, and that any one of the group can do these functions. Because
what
we
about,
don't...
Yeah. What about, I just want to ask one more question about Varma, which is the case that had the dog analogy.
Yes.
The limitation at issue there was not where the first use of the phrase was in the preamble before the word comprising.
That is correct. However, there was a specific linking that every analysis had to be connected to two investments. And it went on, and if you look at the later claims, it always connected those two together as was recited. Whereas in our case here, it's a communication, command, control, and sensing system that has comprising. It means that, and then it has a microprocessor that has said functions. A microprocessor has said functions. And if the principle, again, if a microprocessor cannot be one or more, it has to be a single one, then the Ballman rule has no place here.
Okay. You are in your rebuttal time. Would you like to preserve that time?
Yes, I would like to. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Landis?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Todd Landis on behalf of defendants and cross-appellants. Your Honors, the jury verdict should stand this case for two reasons. First, district court's construction of the microprocessor term was correct. And second, even if it was incorrect, that error was harmless because there were other grounds on which this jury was required to find non-infringement on behalf of the defendants. Even if neither of those apply, this present case should have never gone to the jury because plaintiff's claims were barred by either claim preclusion, the Kessler Doctrine, or both. I'll address each of these in turn.
Okay, I want to ask you, if this court were to agree with the district court's claim construction, would we have to reach the cross appeal? Would we have to reach the Kessler issue?
No, Your Honor.
Okay.
If you found that the court's construction was correct, then that would be the end of this story. The jury found non-infringement in this case, and that would be the only thing that has been appealed by the plaintiff.
But we would also have to address your argument that you didn't fail to preserve your Rule 50 anticipation argument, right?
Yes, Your Honor. Oh, although, Your Honor, I'm not certain that you would have to reach that. I mean, the jury verdict would stand. I think you could not reach that at all, and the jury verdict could still stand based upon the non-infringement finding by itself.
I think under a precedent, we might have to consider validity. We can't just leave validity sitting out there under the Supreme Court precedent, in fact.
Unless
you're right now waiving that issue or saying that we don't have to, in your view, you're going to waive that issue on appeal, then we have to address it.
Yes, Your Honor. I mean, if we have to address it, we have to address it. I think that issue we're going to submit on the papers for the rest for that argument. I think the real heart of this issue is the microprocessor term and how it was construed, properly construed. And to address a few of the issues that I heard raised by the court and by my colleague, the district court found that there was a connection between the claim language and how a microprocessor was gone and the Varma case. And when you look at the claim language itself, I think what's important is the first sentence out of the microprocessor term. That sentence is a microprocessor for generating a plurality of control signals used to operate said system. Said system refers back to the preamble, the communication, command, control, and sensing system. So first, when my colleague over here says there is no connection to the preamble, that's not true. The very first sentence in the microprocessor term connects the preamble to the microprocessor term. But more importantly, when you look at the phrasing of that sentence, it looks like Varma. In Varma, you had a statistical analysis request corresponding to two or more selected investments. That could have been written as a statistical analysis request for two or more investments. We have the same thing here. A microprocessor for generating a plurality of control signals used to operate said system. What the plaintiff would like to do is exactly what the court in Varma warned against. They want to negate the language that comes after A. They want to negate the for language and everything else that comes after A. But when you continue on in the claim, it gets, I think, even more interesting. Because when we get to the first said, now it doesn't say said microprocessor for creating. It says said microprocessor creating. That language, to me, indicates that you're referring to the same microprocessor that was for generating the plurality of control signals. And if you follow this through the claim, you will see that each time the said microprocessor is referred to with respect to another function, there's no longer for. It's always just the ing gerund of that word, creating, generating. The only exception to that would be in the memory device where you have retrieved by the microprocessor, said microprocessor. The other problem with plaintiff's proposal of this construction is, what do we do when we get to the couplings? We have a memory device coupled to said microprocessor. Under plaintiff's construction, as I understand it, is that said microprocessor the microprocessor for creating? The microprocessor creating? The microprocessor for generating? What microprocessor would it be? This gets worse as you move down into the claim. Do you have a user interface?
If I understand correctly, I think you hinted at what you thought your adversary's claim construction to be. I think what you're saying, I just want to make sure I understand. You understand it, as I understand it, I think, to be that there could be multiple different microprocessors that could be either coupled or could be performing all the different functions or being coupled to the different structures.
That's how I understand it, Your Honor, is what they're saying. And when you look at that and put it into this claim, it gets hopelessly, in my opinion, indefinite. You don't know what's going on in the claim. It gets even worse when you go to claim two, where you have even more stuff that needs to be interconnected and more functions that come about.
If they were correct, though, wouldn't that just mean that the claim's broad? Not necessarily indefinite, it's just broad.
It would be broad, but I would also say that if you took their interpretation to its limit, to me, it's just now tantamount to being functional claiming. The microprocessor doesn't matter anymore. They have now just decided to functionally claim. And I hearken this back to means plus function claiming, and I know this is not means plus function claiming here, but I hearken it back to that. When you look at means plus function and you have something that's a computer function, this court has said, you can't just have a general purpose processor. You need to have a specific processor that's specifically programmed to do something. Here, you'd just be functionally claiming, and the processor would be meaningless in many ways. But I think the Varma case is the most appropriate case. The language that follows a microprocessor is defining the interconnections of that microprocessor and what it has to do. And those interconnections, all of those things have to be done by at least one microprocessor, as the district court found. Convolve also reaches this conclusion. This case is much more akin to the claims 1, 3, and 5 in Convolve than it would be the 9 and 15. Because here, we have an interconnection with other components in the claim, which is exactly what claims 1, 3, and 5 in Convolve had, and how the court surmised that those claims were different than claims 9 and 15, and reached the conclusion that, in that case, the microprocessor had to perform the various functions and have the various connections. Unless your honors have any further questions on that, I turn my attention to the harmlessness of the construction. So, your honor, in this case, the claim has another element, a memory device coupled, and it's a lengthy element. There are two halves to that element. The first is that the memory device is coupled to the microprocessor configured to store plurality parameter sets. The district court construed configured to mean a particularized arrangement of the memory device for a specific purpose.
All right, let me just, you said today that if we disagree with the district court on claim construction, that you should win anyway because the jury was required to find non-infringement on these other two grounds. First of all, it was a little unclear from your briefing, but you do accept that that's what we would have to find, that the jury was required to agree with you on one or both of those other non-infringement grounds?
Yes, Your Honor. I think under the court's precedent in Network One, and I'm losing my train of thought in the other case right now, that a reasonable jury would have been required by the evidence.
Right. It's not enough just that there was substantial evidence to support a verdict of non-infringement. That would not be enough.
So I would admit that I think slightly unclear, but the language that has come out of the court is certainly the required language, right, that it's there.
So tell us how on one or both of those the jury would have been required to find non-infringement.
So I'm going to turn to the second half of the memory device claim first, which is where you have such that the memory space required to store said parameters, which the court interpreted as parameter sets, is smaller than the memory space required to store said command code sets. During trial, plaintiff's expert delineated for the court, for the jury, what were the parameter sets and what were the command code sets. And he talked about it in terms of bits. And he was asked how many bits were in the command code set, and he agreed on cross-examination. This is at appendix 1560 line 4 through 1561 line 12, that the command code set had 224 bits of physical memory to store. He was asked those same questions about the parameter sets at appendix 1561 line 13 through appendix 1562 line 8. He admitted that the parameter set had 384 bits of physical memory to store. He was then asked whether there was any empty spaces physically in memory due to those bits, and he had admitted there was not. That's at appendix 1559, 13 through 17, and 18 through 20. To me, that's the end of the story. Their expert admitted in front of the jury that the opposite is true within these devices.
I think you moved for judgment as a matter of law on that ground, didn't you?
We did, Your Honor.
And you were denied.
We were denied. Yes, Your Honor.
So isn't it pretty clear that a reasonable jury didn't have to accept your analysis of the evidence?
I don't know if I would agree with that, Your Honor. I mean, certainly the judge didn't find it to be enough to take it out of the hands of the jury. But when you have both experts agreeing that the very things that their expert identifies as the command code sets and the parameter sets have backward storage capacities from the claims. The command code set takes less room than the parameter set. I don't know how any reasonable jury could not have found non-infringement in those instances. Both experts agreed the claim is the opposite of the claim. In that circumstance, I think a reasonable jury would have to find, would be required to find, non-infringement. Your Honors, I see I'm running up against my my time here a little bit. I just would like to just briefly talk about the claim preclusion and the Kessler Doctrine for a second. To cut to the chase, I just feel like if there's ever a case that I've learned from in law school that should be barred for claim preclusion and IR the Kessler Doctrine, it is this one. We have the same plaintiff, the same patent, the identical claims asserted against 3.8 million of the identical products.
What about the fact that in the first case, there was another ground on which non-infringement could have been found, and that was specifically that the manufacturer, I think, was not performing anything inside the United States, was the argument. So that could have been the basis for the jury's verdict. So why doesn't that make it so collateral estoppel or Kessler would not apply?
Your Honor, I anticipated this question from the court today. The jury verdict form read this. Did Mr. Salazar prove by a preponderance of the evidence that HTC Corporation infringed any of the asserted claims through the use, sale, or offer for sale in the United States, proper under the law, or importation in the United States of any of the following accused products, and then it listed the three products that are in both cases. The jury was obligated under that jury instruction to look at use, sale, offer for sale, and importation. Plaintiff presented numerous evidence and argument to the jury about offer for sale, including all of the contracts between HTC and each of these defendants.
But doesn't that all fundamentally mean we cannot tell whether the jury found non-infringement on the basis of lack of action by HTC in the U.S., or whether they found it perhaps additionally because the product didn't meet all the elements of the claims? We just can't tell.
But, Your Honor, I think what I'm saying to the court is the evidence that was presented on offer for sale, there was no evidence presented that none of that occurred in the United States. It was all in the United States.
But there was an extraterritoriality defense. In fact, it appears to be
for importation.
Primary defense. But this was the only infringement question the jury was asked, isn't it?
This is the only infringement question with the ORs in it. And I think that's the important point, is that the jury had to look at each of these things and make a decision. And since they answered the question no and not yes on any of them.
You're saying that because the jury verdict question was, did A happen or B happen? They had to actually consider both?
I think it's actually four things, Your Honor. But I would say yes. That's what the jury question would obligation.
If the question was, is there no infringement because of A or B? Why, once they decide there is an infringement because of A, why do they need to move on to B?
Well, because the court didn't just say it's infringed any of the asserted claims through each of these. So, I mean, the way it's written, the court is asking through use, through sale, through offer for sale.
That's not how the case was tried, though, right? HTC argued very clearly you can find non-infringement based on lack of action in the U.S. Or, here's another one, you can find non-infringement based on we don't practice all the elements of the claims.
Your Honor, I fully admit that that's true, that we argued before this jury about who was the importer into the United States. That was before this jury.
And told the jury, this is in the first case, told the first jury, you can rule for us without even considering the elements of the claims if you just simply find we didn't take any action in the U.S., right?
Yes, Your Honor, that is very true. But that may impact Kessler, but I'm not sure it impacts claim preclusion. Because in claim preclusion, the Supreme Court has said, and this is from New Hampshire v. Maine, successive litigation of the very same, whether or not relitigation of the claim raises the same issues as the earlier suit. There were different issues there, but here under claim preclusion, the parties are in privity. There was a judgment rendered by a court.
Isn't it true that the extraterritoriality defense would only apply to HTC? It would not apply to AT&T, right?
Absolutely.
Okay.
But AT&T was in the first case and was dismissed from the first case prior to trial by the plaintiff. This was an issue they could have raised, and that's what claim preclusion is for. I see I'm over my time, Your Honors.
Thank you. I'll just take a little bit of your time.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'll first address the procedural matter. Your Honors are on point. The jury instructions just did not make clear what was the basis for their ultimate decision of non-infringement. And because we don't know if they decided non-infringement because they were convinced that the sale did not occur in the United States or because the claim elements of the patent were not met, either one of those theories could have been the basis. And we did not, so those products did not get that trade right. They did not get it clear, so to speak, for the purposes of claim preclusion under Kessler, the products didn't get it clear, and Kessler doesn't apply here because Kessler only relates to post-judgment allegations of infringement, which there were none here. In the case of claim preclusion, we don't have the same claim or cause of action because one related to claims outside of the United States, transactions outside the United States, and one related to transactions within the United States. So we did not get a resolution of the basic issue as to whether or not the claim elements were actually met by these products. As a matter of privity, as a matter of the same, not being the same claim or cause of action, but even more importantly, Your Honors, the HTC and AT&T argued in the first case that Salazar should not be able to add AT&T to the case. They could not add them because it was a separate transaction and occurrence under Section 299 of the American Invents Act. They've taken that position, and that's why, and then the court severed the case, split the case. It would be inequitable, it would be contrary to good policy, and it's a waiver of the claim preclusion argument under the second restatement of judgments, Section 26(1A). It's a basic principle that if you argue to split the case as a defendant, you can't later argue claim preclusion. And that's exactly what HTC and AT&T did. And consequently, so there can be claim preclusion for that reason. And of course, as a doctrinal matter, as an equity matter, as a policy matter. And with respect to the validity argument, yes, clearly a reasonable jury could have found that there was non-infringement. I would say that Judge Gilstrap, in ruling on the Rule 50, was making a decision as to whether a reasonable jury could find for the plaintiff, and the court proceeded to move forward with the case. So I don't think there's any question that a reasonable jury could have found non-infringement. So I don't think that's a compelling argument. Just coming back to the claim construction issue, the law of this court makes very clear that there must be unmistakable, clear intent either in the prosecution history, either in the specification or claim language, if you're going to narrow or go away from sort of the Baldwin rule that a component means one or more. And The structure of the claim in Salazar speaks to a communication, command, control, and sensing system comprising a microprocessor. A microprocessor under Baldwin and progeny means one or more microprocessors. Then you have, it's either coupled to various things or it has various, statements that it's for certain purposes. There's no language in this, unlike in Varma where there was a very specific, or let's take Convolve, where there was a very specific connection in the preamble, in this case of Convolve, and yes, you're correct, and in Varma it was not in the preamble, connecting either the user interface to the processor in the preamble in Convolve. The court compared two sets of claims and found in one set of claims there wasn't that precise link and found that it wasn't limiting. And in the case where the user interface was linked specifically to the processor in Convolve, in the preamble, the court then found that, okay, now those two have to be together, and the fact that it's A was one or more, we find exception. But where the claim language in Convolve, with respect to claims 9 and 15, recited apparatus for controlling operation of data storage device, the apparatus comprising, we say this is, and then they had various elements comprising, the court found that it wasn't limiting. And we argue that Salazar's case really is, as opposed to, is just like an apparatus. It's a communication, command, control, and sensing system here. There is no limitations recited in the preamble. And then you go on, and then it talks about a microprocessor that has various limitations. And those limitations could, you can't reinvoke the plurality. You don't lose the plurality when you have a definite article said or the. In this case, the said microprocessor just refers back to the group. Why would you limit it to a single microprocessor? If you say that said only goes back to a single, then where's the Baldwin rule? It's no longer one or more. It could just be equal to one microprocessor. It renders the rule meaningless. And in many claims out there that are in patents, you have this structure where you have a something with various other limitations. If we say that every time there are other limitations around the definite article, and that's going to limit it to a single component, then when would the Baldwin rule ever apply?
We understand your argument, Mr. Kihani. I think you're about out of time. Did you want to summarize that up or add anything else?
I would just say, Your Honor, that we believe that as a matter of policy and as a matter of equity, claim preclusion should not apply, as well as because there is no privity between the carriers and HTC. And it was a different claim and cause of action. On Kessler, that's a red herring, Your Honor. Kessler is limited to post-judgment infringement activities or allegations of infringement. There was none of that. The patent was expired. On validity, okay. We pointed out it was
right. I think you're out of time.
All right.
But thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Landis?
Your Honor, I have nothing further.
Okay.
If you have a question for me, I'm happy to answer it.
We don't have any questions. Thank you very much. Okay, the case will be submitted on the briefs. We thank counsel for their argument.
Thank you.